3. The Third Declaration of War, 1967. I was trying to see how an event is made and unmade, as ultimately it only exists via what one says about it, since it is, properly speaking, fabricated by those who spread its renown. Georges Duby. On a bright, sunny morning in early June 1967, I walked out of Grand Central Station in Manhattan, en route from our family home in Mount Vernon to my father's office in the United Nations building. The Six-Day War was raging in the Middle East, and the news reports indicated that the Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian air forces had been wiped out in a first strike by Israel. I dreaded the prospect of another crushing Israeli victory, but even with my limited exposure to military strategy, I knew that an army in the desert without air cover would be easy pickings for any air force, especially one as powerful as Israel's. Out on 42nd Street, I noticed a commotion. Several people on the sidewalk were holding the corners of a large bedsheet, which was weighed down with a heap of coins and bills. Others were coming from every direction to throw in more money. I stopped momentarily to watch and realized that the people were soliciting contributions for Israel's war effort. It struck me that while my family and many others were preoccupied with the fate of Palestine, lots of New Yorkers were just as worried about the outcome for Israel. They sincerely believed that the Jewish state was in danger of extinction, as did many Israelis, alarmed by the empty threats of certain Arab leaders. President Lyndon B. Johnson knew otherwise. When Abba Iban, Israel's foreign minister, told Johnson at a meeting in Washington, D.C. on May 26th that Egypt was about to launch an attack, the president asked his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, to set the record straight. Three separate intelligence groups had looked carefully into the matter, McNamara said, and it was our best judgment that an attack was not imminent. All of our intelligence people are unanimous, Johnson added, that if Egypt were to attack, you will whip hell out of them. As Washington knew, Israel's military in 1967 was far superior to the militaries of all the Arab states combined, as it was in every other contest between them. Government documents published since then have confirmed these judgments. U.S. military and intelligence sources predicted a crushing victory by Israel in any and all circumstances, given the mastery enjoyed by its armed forces. 5 years after the 1967 war, five Israeli generals echoed the U.S. assessment, stating in different venues that Israel was not imperiled by annihilation. On the contrary, its forces were much stronger than the Arab armies in 1967, and the country was never in any danger of losing a war, even if the Arabs had struck first. Yet the myth prevails. In 1967, a tiny, vulnerable country faced constant existential peril, and it continues to do so. This fiction has served to justify blanket support of Israeli policies, no matter how extreme, and despite its repeated rebuttal, even by authoritative Israeli voices. The war unfolded much as the CIA and Pentagon had foreseen. A lightning first strike by the Israeli Air Force destroyed most Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian warplanes on the ground. This gave Israel complete air superiority, which in that desert region, in that season, provided an absolute advantage to its ground forces. Israeli armored columns thus were able to conquer the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, including Arab East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights in 6 days. If the reasons for Israel's decisive victory in June 1967 are clear, the factors that led to the war are less so. A key cause was the rise of militant Palestinian commando groups. The Israeli government had recently begun to divert the waters of the Jordan River to the center of the country, despite great Arab popular distress and even greater impotence on the part of the Arab regimes. On January 1, 1965, Fatah launched an attack to sabotage a water pumping station in central Israel. This was intended as a strike of symbolic significance, the first of many, designed to show that the Palestinians could act effectively when the Arab governments could not, and to embarrass those governments and force them to act. Fatah was regarded with suspicion by Egyptian officials as a loose cannon, recklessly provoking Israel at a time when Egypt was heavily engaged in military intervention in a civil war in Yemen and in building up its economy. This was at the height of what the scholar Malcolm Kerr called the Arab Cold War, when Egypt led a coalition of radical Arab nationalist regimes opposed to the conservative bloc headed by Saudi Arabia. The flashpoint of their rivalry was Yemen, where a revolution against the monarchy in 1962 led to a civil war in which much of Egypt's military became entangled. Given Israel's overwhelming military superiority, and the fact that more than 60,000 Egyptian troops and much of its air force were tied down in the Yemeni civil war, Egypt's provocation of Israel in May 1967 by moving troops into the Sinai Peninsula and requesting the removal of UN peacekeeping forces appears illogical. But Egypt was responding to an upsurge of Palestinian guerrilla raids on Israel from bases provided by the radical new Syrian regime that had come to power in 1966, to which Israel had reacted by attacking and threatening Syria. The Egyptian leadership felt obliged to answer this challenge to maintain its prestige in the Arab world. Whatever its motives, Egypt's moves in Sinai constituted overt incitement of Israel. Moreover, they provided the casus belli that allowed the Israeli military to launch a long-planned first strike, one that smashed three Arab armies and changed the face of the Middle East. Every morning during the war, I headed down to the UN, changing my route to avoid the bedsheet fundraisers, to my father's 35th floor office, with its panoramic view of the East River in Queens. He worked in the Division of Political and Security Council Affairs, and one of his jobs was to report on the Council's Middle East deliberations. So he sat in on Security Council meetings whenever the Arab-Israeli conflict was discussed, which meant about half of its sessions during the decade and a half that he worked there, until he died in 1968. At his office, I listened to the radio, read the news, and generally tried to make myself useful until the council was called into session. I was then able to sit in the visitors' gallery while my father would take his seat in the last row, behind the assistant secretary general in charge of his division. This particular official, by some arcane early Cold War deal that perhaps went back to Yalta, was always a Russian, a Belarusian, or a Ukrainian. The council had been in formal or informal session repeatedly since the crisis had begun in earnest the preceding month. During the 6 days of the war itself, the council held 11 sessions, many of them running into the early hours of the morning. The pace and the workload were grueling, and my father, who with his colleagues had to spend many hours preparing materials for the council and secretary general, and then drafting reports on each session, looks haggard and drawn in photos taken at that time. By Friday, June 9th, the fifth day of the war, Israeli forces had decisively defeated the Egyptian and Jordanian armies and occupied the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, and Arab East Jerusalem. Early that morning, Israel had begun storming the Golan Heights, routing the Syrian army, and was advancing rapidly along the main road toward Damascus. The council had ordered comprehensive ceasefires on June 6th and 7th, but Israeli forces entering Syria ignored these resolutions, even as their government loudly proclaimed its adherence to them. By that night in the Middle East, still afternoon in New York, Israel's forces were approaching the key provincial capital of Quneitra, beyond which stood only the flat Hauran plain between their armored columns and the Syrian capital, just 40 miles away. Early in the council's session, which started at 12:30 p.m., the Soviet Union proposed a draft of a third and more urgent ceasefire resolution. At this point, after the humiliating defeat of the Soviet-equipped Egyptian army and the seizure of the Golan Heights, the Soviets were desperate to protect their Syrian clients from further reverses, especially from an Israeli march on Damascus. The urgency was reflected in the increasingly testy interventions in the debate by Ambassador Nikolai Fedorenko, the Soviet representative. The resolution SC-235, which passed unanimously at about 1:30 p.m., demanded of all parties to the conflict that hostilities should cease forthwith. Unusually, it also called on the UN Secretary General to arrange immediate compliance with the ceasefire and report back to the Council not later than 2 hours from now. As the session wore on into the afternoon, I fidgeted nervously, waiting for the Secretary General's confirmation of compliance with the ceasefire. This would signal that the fighting had been brought to an end and the Israeli advance had been halted. But as the minutes ticked by, Fresh reports kept coming in of Israeli troops getting closer and closer to Damascus. It seemed as if the council might have been on the point of taking some action to enforce its demand for an immediate ceasefire when Ambassador Arthur Goldberg, the U.S. representative, asked for an adjournment. After a desultory discussion, the council agreed to adjourn for 2 hours, and the delegations slowly filed out of the chamber. I rushed down to meet my father, expecting him to explain why the council had agreed to allow another 2 hours of delay. Goldberg wanted to consult with his government, my father told me flatly. I was incredulous. How much consultation was needed to impose a ceasefire resolution? With a strange, bitter smile, my father responded dispassionately in Arabic. Don't you understand, he said. The Americans are giving the Israelis a little more time. Thanks to Ambassador Goldberg's maneuver to delay implementation of the June 9th ceasefire resolution for a few extra hours, the Israeli advance into Syria did not stop, and it continued until the following afternoon. By then, the Security Council had spent 9 more hours in acrimonious debate, stretching over 3 more sessions and running into the early hours of June 10th. Throughout, Goldberg had reprised his delaying tactics. Minor though the incident was, the ambassador's performance betokened a major shift in the United States policies toward Israel. What we had witnessed that day was evidence of a new Middle Eastern axis in action. The armored spearheads on the ground were Israeli, while the diplomatic cover was American. It is an axis that is still in place today, over a half century later. The shift, which had been underway for some time, was mainly due to global factors, notably the impact of the Cold War and the Vietnam War on the region and on U.S. policy, but also to significant personal and political considerations in Washington, D.C., evolving in parallel were Israel's external alliances, whereby it decisively moved away from its patrons of the 1950s and early 1960s, France and Britain, with whose weapons it fought the 1956 and 1967 wars, to a complete alignment with the United States. All of these factors had coalesced by June 1967, before the start of the war, when the Israeli government sought and received a green light from Washington to launch a preemptive attack on the air forces of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. If the Balfour Declaration and the Mandate constituted the first declaration of war on the Palestinian people by a great power, and the 1947 UN resolution on the partition of Palestine represented the second one, the aftermath of the 1967 war produced the third such declaration. It came in the form of SC-242, a resolution crafted by the United States and approved on November 22, 1967. U.S. policy toward Israel and Palestine had not followed a straight line in the 20 years between the passage of these two resolutions. In the years that followed the 1948 war, the Truman and Eisenhower administrations had tried rather tepidly and without success to persuade Israel to offer some concessions to its defeated adversaries. Their efforts focused on the return to their homes of the 750,000 or so Palestinian refugees whose property had been seized by Israel, and on reducing the expansive borders Israel had achieved through its victories in the 1948 war. These feeble American attempts petered out in the face of the obduracy of David Ben-Gurion, who rejected concessions on both points. The Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy administrations maintained close relations with Israel, extending economic aid to the new state, although they did not see it as a principal element in their regional policies and did not approve of all of its actions. Eisenhower had forced Israel's withdrawal from Sinai and the Gaza Strip after the 1956 Suez War, and later, Kennedy tried and failed to prevent Israel from developing nuclear weapons. In the early 1960s, Kennedy came to see Arab nationalism and Egypt's Nasser as a bulwark against communism, which was the prime American concern in the Middle East. This was in part because of events in Iraq, where the regime of Abdel Karim Qasim was supported by the Iraqi Communist Party and the USSR, but vigorously opposed by Egypt and its nationalist allies. With Kennedy's assassination and the advent of the Johnson administration in December 1963, new elements intervened. As the war in Southeast Asia intensified, Johnson's government was ever more inclined to see other parts of the world in rigid Cold War terms. Partly in consequence, U.S.-Egyptian relations deteriorated markedly as the Yemeni civil war that had begun in 1962 turned into a major regional conflict. The USSR and its allies backed the Yemeni Republican regime, which relied upon a large Egyptian expeditionary force, while the United States, Britain, Israel, and their allies upheld the Saudi-supported royalists. By 1967, U.S. relations with Egypt were much colder than they had been under Kennedy, and the Middle East was polarized along lines of the Arab Cold War, with Egypt and Saudi Arabia as its antagonistic poles. This conflict increasingly ran parallel to the larger global Cold War, but it had its own regional specificities. These included an ideological struggle not between communism and capitalism, but rather between the authoritarian Arab nationalism promoted by Egypt and the political Islam centered on Wahhabism and absolute monarchy that was purveyed by Saudi Arabia under King Faisal. The realignment of American Middle Eastern priorities was also affected by President Johnson's long-standing and overt sympathy for Israel. As Senate Majority Leader in 1956, he had opposed Eisenhower's pressure on Israel to withdraw from Sinai and the Gaza Strip. Johnson was also relatively unfamiliar with Middle Eastern and other global realities. By contrast, Kennedy, the worldly and wealthy son of an ambassador, had visited Palestine in the early summer of 1939, when he was a 22-year-old Harvard student, and sent his father a letter in which he demonstrated a reasonably good grasp of the facts and a skeptical assessment of the main arguments of both sides in the conflict. This skepticism made Kennedy less susceptible than most American politicians to the pressures applied by Israel's supporters. Lyndon Johnson, on the other hand, came from a much more modest background, and his primary interests had revolved around domestic politics. His strong affinity with Zionism and Israel was reflected in his circle of close friends and advisors, which included such supporters of Israel as Abe Fortas, whom he made a Supreme Court justice, Arthur Goldberg, McGeorge Bundy, Clark Clifford, and the brothers Eugene and Walter Rostow. All were devoted backers of the Jewish state, whose sympathies had to some extent been held in check by Kennedy. Other avid Israel boosters who were personally close to Johnson were also major donors to the Democratic Party, such as Abraham Feinberg and Arthur Krim, and the latter's wife, Dr. Matilda Krim, a renowned scientist who had once smuggled weapons and explosives for the revisionist Zionist terror group, the Irgun. Although Johnson had inherited most of Kennedy's foreign policy advisors, they had considerably more prominence in an administration led by a president with less experience and assurance in world affairs than Kennedy had. These political and personal factors combined in the 3 years leading up to the 1967 war to prepare the way for the ensuing shift in U.S. policy. Israel, for its part, had been stung by the strong American opposition to its 1956 Suez adventure. As it prepared in 1967 for a first strike against the Arab Air Forces, its leaders were determined to get prior American approval for their action, which they indeed obtained. A crucial exchange took place at a meeting in Washington on June 1, 1967, during which Major General Meir Amit, the head of the Mossad, Israel's external intelligence agency, told Secretary of Defense McNamara that he was going to recommend to his own government that Israel launch an attack. He asked the secretary for assurances that the United States would not react negatively. According to Amit, McNamara replied, "All right," said he would tell the president, and asked only how long the war would last and what Israeli casualties might be. Johnson and McNamara had already heard from their military and intelligence advisors that the Arabs were not going to attack, and that in any case, Israel was likely to win an overwhelming victory. The Israeli military now had the green light it needed to launch a long-planned preemptive strike. The United States facilitated Israel's first strike in other ways. At a small meeting of Arab UN officials and diplomats after the war, Mohammed Al-Farah, Jordan's ambassador, told the group that he felt he had been the victim of American duplicity in the run-up to the war. Ambassador Goldberg, he said, had conveyed to Arab ambassadors that the United States was mediating with Israel to defuse the crisis and would restrain it from attacking, while he urged them to counsel restraint to their governments. The Johnson administration had given Israel the go-ahead for its surprise attack, Al-Farah said, just before Egypt's vice president arrived in Washington for negotiations to resolve the crisis. The Arab ambassadors had been used to deceive their governments, he felt, while Israel prepared its first strike with U.S. approval. No less important was that given this shift in U.S. policy, Israel could count on President Johnson and his advisors to prevent a repetition of the pressure that had forced a withdrawal from its 1956 conquests. This was a complete transformation of the U.S. stance in 1956 on Israeli control of conquered Arab territory, and its ramifications were disastrous for the Palestinians. The result of this new tolerance for Israeli territorial gains was Security Council Resolution 242. Its text was largely drafted by the British Permanent Representative, Lord Carradine, but in essence it distilled the views of the United States and Israel and reflected the weakened position of the Arab states and their Soviet patron after the crushing June defeat. Although SC 242 stressed the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, it linked any Israeli withdrawal to peace treaties with the Arab states and the establishment of secure frontiers. In practice, this meant that any withdrawals would be both conditional and delayed. Given the Arab states' reluctance to engage in direct negotiations with Israel. Indeed, in the case of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, full withdrawals have not taken place for over half a century, in spite of decades of sporadic indirect and direct negotiations. Moreover, by linking Israel's withdrawal from occupied territories to the creation of secure and recognized boundaries, SC 242 allowed for the possibility of enlarged Israeli borders to meet the criterion of security, as determined by Israel. This nuclear-armed regional superpower has subsequently deployed an extraordinarily expansive and flexible interpretation of the term. Finally, the ambiguous language of SC 242 left open another loophole for Israel to retain the territories it had just occupied. The resolution's English text specifies withdrawal from territories occupied in the 1967 war rather than from the territories occupied. Abba Iban pointedly stressed to the Security Council that his government would regard the original English language text as binding rather than the equally official French version, whose wording, des territoires occupés, does not permit this ambiguity. In the half century since, with American help, Israel has driven a coach and horses through this linguistic gap, which has permitted it to colonize the occupied Palestinian and Syrian territories, some of which, East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, it has formally annexed, and to maintain its unending military control over them. Repeated United Nations condemnations of these moves, unsupported by even a hint of sanctions or any genuine pressure on Israel, have over time amounted to tacit international acceptance of them. The United States was now more squarely on the side of Israel than it had been previously, which meant the abandonment of the semblance of balance shown at times by the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy administrations. This was the beginning of what became the classical period of the Arab-Israeli conflict, lasting until the end of the Cold War, during which the United States and Israel developed a unique full-scale, albeit informal, alliance, based essentially on Israel showing itself in 1967 as a reliable partner against perceived Soviet proxies in the Middle East. For the Palestinians, this near-total alignment brought another forceful intervention by a great power to the detriment of their rights and interests, and gave a renewed international imprimatur to a further stage in their dispossession. As in 1947, a new international legal formula harmful to the Palestinians came via the medium of a UN resolution, and as with the Balfour Declaration of 1917, the key document contains not a single mention of Palestine or the Palestinians. Security Council Resolution 242 treated the entire issue as a state-to-state matter between the Arab countries and Israel, eliminating the presence of Palestinians. The text does not refer to the Palestinians or to most elements of the original Palestine question. Instead, it contains a bland reference to a just solution of the refugee problem. If the Palestinians were not mentioned and were not a recognized party to the conflict, they could be treated as no more than a nuisance, or at best as a humanitarian issue. Indeed, after 1967, their existence was acknowledged mostly under the rubric of terrorism purveyed by Israel and eventually adopted by the United States. By its omissions, Resolution 242 consecrated a crucial element of Israel's negationist narrative, Since there were no Palestinians, the only genuine issue was that the Arab states refused to recognize Israel and wielded a phantom Palestine problem as a pretext for this refusal. In the discursive battle over Palestine, which Zionism had dominated since 1897, UNSC 242 gave validity to this brilliant fabrication, delivering a powerful blow to the displaced and occupied Palestinians. Only 2 years later, in 1969, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously proclaimed that there were no such thing as Palestinians, they did not exist, and that they never had existed. She thereby took the negation characteristic of a settler colonial project to the highest possible level. The indigenous people were nothing but a lie. Perhaps most important, Resolution 242 effectively legitimated the 1949 armistice lines, since known as the 1967 borders, or the Green Line, as Israel's de facto boundaries, thereby indirectly consenting to its conquest of most of Palestine in the 1948 war. The failure to refer to core issues dating back to 1948 extended to ignoring the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and obtain compensation, another blow to their aspirations. With Resolution 242, the UN was walking away from its own commitment to these rights, consecrated by the General Assembly in Resolution 194 in December 1948. Once again, the Palestinians were being dealt with by the great powers in a cavalier fashion, their rights ignored, deemed not worthy of mention by name in the key international decision meant to resolve the conflict and determine their fate. This slight further motivated the Palestinians' reviving national movement to put its case and cause before the international community. Thanks in large part to SC 242, a whole new layer of forgetting, of erasure and myth-making, was added to the induced amnesia that obscured the colonial origins of the conflict between Palestinians and the Zionist settlers. The resolution's exclusive focus on the results of the 1967 war made it possible to ignore the fact that none of the underlying issues resulting from the 1948 war had been resolved in the intervening 19 years. Along with the expulsion of the Palestinian refugees, the refusal to allow them to return, the theft of their property, and the denial of Palestinian self-determination, these included the legal status of Jerusalem and Israel's expansion beyond the 1947 partition frontiers. As for the core problems arising from the original usurpation of Palestine, SC 242 did not even refer to them, much less offer any solutions. Yet the resolution henceforth became the benchmark for resolving the entire conflict, nominally accepted by all parties, even as it passed over the basic aspects of the conflict in silence. In view of the resolution's perverse genesis, it is not surprising that over 50 years after it was adopted, UNSC 242 remains unimplemented and the essence of the struggle over Palestine remains unaddressed. Indeed, SC 242 exacerbated the problem. Confining the conflict to its post-1948 state-to-state dimensions made it possible to split the challenges facing Israel into separate bilateral state-to-state compartments, each of which could be dealt with in isolation, as Israel and the United States preferred, while ignoring the most difficult and uncomfortable questions. Instead of being obliged to confront a nominally unified Arab position and engage the tough issues relating to the Palestinians, Israel now had the far easier task of dealing on a bilateral basis with the grievances of individual Arab states whose territory it had occupied, while sidelining the Palestinians. In Israel's effort to divide its enemies and deal with them separately, the United States was of enormous help, using its power and influence to play on the Arab states' weaknesses and rivalries. This was seen as being in the U.S. interest, too. Characteristically, Henry Kissinger put this pithily, speaking of another Middle Eastern crisis. "The end result would be exactly what we have worked all these years to avoid. It would create Arab unity." The United States had multiple reasons to prevent such unity, primarily to fend off threats to its regional dominance, and in particular to the fragile oil autocracies of the Gulf with which it was closely aligned. Following the push by the United States and Israel for bilateral settlements, Egypt in the 1970s and then Jordan in the 1990s negotiated separate peace treaties with Israel. These countries were thereby removed from the conflict, leaving Israel in an even stronger position to deal with its more intractable foes, the Syrians, the Lebanese, and of course the Palestinians. To most people in the Arab world, however, the stark contrast between Arab normalization with Israel and the misery that its colonization and occupation inflicted on the Palestinians inevitably undermined any faith in an American-sponsored peace process. In and of itself, SC 242 did not force the Arab states to accept the bilateralization and fragmentation of the conflict. Other factors were at work. Among them, the impact of Egypt's defeat in 1967, its subsequent withdrawal from Yemen, both of which marked the end of its attempt to assert regional hegemony. Egypt's diminution left its rival Saudi Arabia as the dominant actor in the Arab world, a situation that continues to the present day. The failure of the Arab socialist model adopted by the authoritarian nationalist regimes and the pronounced regional weakness of the USSR also played a role in their capitulation. At different times, encouraged by the United States, the Arab countries walked into the trap of separate settlements with open eyes, eventually abandoning any semblance of unity or even minimal coordination. Even the Palestinians, represented by the PLO, eventually traveled down the path laid out in SC 242. Only a few years after the Arab states accepted 242 and the bilateral approach as a basis for a resolution of the conflict, the PLO leadership followed. There is another side to the story of what happened in 1967, however. For all the harm the war and SC 242 did to the Palestinians, they ultimately served as the spark to their reviving national movement, which had been declining since the defeat of the 1936-39 revolt. The process of revival had started well before the 1967 war, of course, playing a crucial role in precipitating that and the 1956 war. Still, 1967 marked an extraordinary resurgence of Palestinian national consciousness and resistance to Israel's negation of Palestinian identity, a negation made possible by the complicity of much of the world community. In the words of one seasoned observer, a central paradox of 1967 is that by defeating the Arabs, Israel resurrected the Palestinians. The resurrection of the idea of Palestine faced an uphill battle in the wake of the 1967 war in most parts of the world. The year after the war, I joined a tiny demonstration to protest the appearance of Golda Meir, who had been invited to speak at Yale Law School. She was rapturously received by a large and appreciative audience, while, as I recall it, our demonstration consisted of a total of four protesters, myself, a Lebanese-American friend, a Sudanese graduate student, and one American who had lived in the Middle East. That scene accurately represented the balance between Israel and Palestine in American opinion. The Zionist narrative enjoyed complete dominance, while the very word Palestine was almost unmentionable. In Beirut, on the other hand, where I now spent the summers with my mother and brothers, I was witness to an important resurgence of Palestinian political agency. Writers and poets, both throughout the Palestinian diaspora and living inside Palestine, Ghassan Kanafani, Mahmoud Darwish, Emil Habibi, Fadwa Tuqan, and Tawfiq Zayad, together with other gifted and engaged artists and intellectuals, played a vital role in this renaissance, culturally and politically. Their work helped to reshape a sense of Palestinian identity and purpose that had been tested by the Nakba and the barren years that followed. In novels, short stories, plays, and poetry, they gave voice to a shared national experience of loss, exile, alienation. At the same time, they evinced a stubborn insistence on the continuity of Palestinian identity and steadfastness in the face of daunting odds. These different facets are evident in one of the best known of these works, Emil Habibi's The Pessimist, a brilliant novella that traces the tragicomic tale of its protagonist, Saeed, using his fate to portray the plight of the Palestinians and their resilience. The work's full title, The Strange Incidents Around the Disappearance of Saeed, Father of Nahas, the Pessimist, conveys the essential paradox of the Palestinian situation, happiness expressed in the name of Sa'id, which means happy, and calamity or nahas. Both are contained in the portmanteau word pessimist. Among the literary figures whose ideas and images played a major role in the revival of Palestinian identity, Kenafani was perhaps the most prominent prose writer and the most widely translated. His five novellas, notably Men in the Sun, 1963, and Return to Haifa, 1969, are widely popular, perhaps because they depict so vividly the dilemmas faced by Palestinians. The travails of exile and the pain of life in post-1967 Palestine, now entirely under Israeli control. The novellas encouraged Palestinians to confront their dire predicament and forcefully resist the powers that oppressed them. Return to Haifa stressed the importance of armed struggle, while at the same time poignantly depicting an Israeli Holocaust survivor living in the home of a Palestinian family that returns to visit after 1967. Kenafani was also a prolific journalist, steeped in Palestinian resistance literature. Indeed, he may have coined the term in a collection he published under that title, and he had been deeply involved in politics since his late teens. Born in Acre in 1936, he and his family had been forced to flee their home during the Zionist offensive of May 1948, first settling in Damascus. When I met him in Beirut, he was 33 years old and the editor of Al-Haddaf, the weekly magazine of the Radical Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, of which Kenafani was also the public spokesman. He won others over not only with his literary talent, but also with his manifest intelligence, his self-deprecating and sardonic sense of humor, and his pleasant, open demeanor and ready smile. In light of his literary renown and militant activism, he was a significant figure in the revived Palestinian national movement. For the same reason, he was a target of the PFLP's enemies, the foremost being the Israeli government and its intelligence services. In July 1972, Kenafani was assassinated in a car bombing by the Mossad, together with his 17-year-old niece, Lamis Najam. His enormous funeral, which I attended, drew what seemed to be hundreds of thousands of people mourning him. It was the first of many funerals of Palestinian leaders and militants that I would attend during my 15 years in Beirut. Kenafani was pursued even in death. An English stage adaptation of Return to Haifa was commissioned by the Public Theater in New York but never produced. Members of its board opposed staging work by Kenafani, who had been dubbed a terrorist. The reshaping and revival of Palestinian identity that Kenafani, Darwish, Zayad, Telqan, Habibi, and others helped to spark with their literary output went in tandem with the rise of new political movements and armed groups. After 1948, Palestine had ceased to exist on the map, with most of the country absorbed into Israel and the rest under the control of Jordan and Egypt. Palestinians had almost no voice, no central address, and no champions other than the bickering, self-interested Arab states. The Zionist movement's deepest desire had been to transform Palestine into Israel and replace the country's indigenous inhabitants with Jewish immigrants. After 1948, it appeared as if the Palestinians had largely disappeared, both physically and as an idea. The Palestinians, of course, had not disappeared in the years after 1948. The collective trauma of the Nakba had perversely cemented and reinforced their identity, and the small, irredentist militant groups that arose in the 1950s had already had a significant impact on the Middle East, having played a role in triggering both the 1956 and 1967 wars. These groups were founded by young middle-class and lower-middle-class radicals, many of whom saw themselves as the progeny of Sheikh Izz al-Din al-Qassam, whose death in battle with the British had been one of the sparks of the 1936 revolt and who remained a revered symbol of heroic armed militancy. They continued after 1956 to work to re-establish the Palestinians as a regional force and to represent their rights and interests. In the 1960s, these efforts culminated in two main trends. One was led by the Movement of Arab Nationalists, a pan-Arab organization founded largely by Palestinians, which gave birth in 1967 to the Marxist PFLP. The other was headed by a group formally established in Kuwait in 1959, and which in 1965 publicly announced itself as Fatah. The origins of both go back to the late 1940s and early 1950s, when their first leaders were university students or recent graduates. MAN was founded by George Habash, a physician trained at the American University of Beirut who had experienced the Nakba as a young man in Lydd, a town that was depopulated after 1948, resettled with Jewish immigrants, and renamed Lod. Habash set up MAN together with a group of other young Palestinians and Arabs, most of them middle-class professionals like himself and his closest collaborator, Wadi Haddad, another AUB-trained physician. Habash and his colleagues argued for Arab unity around the question of Palestine as the sole means to reverse the results of the Nakba. After Nasser's Egypt became the standard-bearer for Arab nationalism in the mid-1950s, a close alignment between MAN and the Egyptian regime developed. MAN profited greatly from this alliance, becoming a pan-Arab political force, implanted in countries from Libya and Yemen to Kuwait, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Egyptian foreign policy benefited as well from its connection with MAN's widespread network of young militants. Habash, Haddad, and their comrades' view of Palestine as the central issue for the Arab world had in large measure been imparted to them at the American University of Beirut by the historian and intellectual Constantine Zureiq through a student organization, Al-Urwa Al-Wuthqa, of which Zureiq was the mentor and to which my father belonged. This influential, Syrian-born, Princeton-trained professor of history did much to spread the ideas of Arab nationalism and the centrality of the Palestine issue in lectures to his students in Beirut and to people across the Arab world through his writings. His short 86-page book, The Meaning of the Catastrophe, was one of the first postmortems of the 1948 defeat, written while the war was ongoing and featured perhaps the first use of the word Nakba in this context. Zureiq argued in it for rigorous, introspective self-criticism of Arab weaknesses and failures, and for Arab coordination and unity as the only means of overcoming the effects of the 1948 disaster. My father studied with Zureiq at the AUB in the late 1930s and was strongly influenced by him. Several of Zureiq's historical and political books, some inscribed by the author, were in my father's library. When I first met Zureiq in the early 1970s in Beirut at the Institute for Palestine Studies, of which he was a co-founder, he urged me and other young historians associated with the IPS to focus on the future. This was more important than history, he seemed to imply, which had already been written by him and his generation. Faced by an upsurge of activist, nationalist sentiment, spurred by Fatah's first military operation, carried out in January 1965, and feeling the need to keep up with one of its core constituencies, MAN was forced to move away from its broad Arab nationalist stance and concentrate more on Palestine. The defeat of Egypt and Syria in 1967 put the last nail in the coffin of MAN's reliance on the Arab regimes to resolve the question of Palestine. The result was the formation of the PFLP by Habash and his colleagues in 1967. Although it was not the largest Palestinian group, the PFLP rapidly became the most dynamic, a stature it maintained for several years. It carried out multiple airplane hijackings in that short time. These were masterminded by Wadi Haddad, as were most of what it called its external operations, seen as terrorist attacks by much of the world. Much of the prestige that the group enjoyed among Palestinians was due to the image and integrity of Habash, who was respected even by his political rivals. He was known as Al-Hakim, the doctor, which he was, but the term is also used for someone who is wise, and it was applied to Habash in both senses. He was a riveting speaker, especially in small groups where his articulate and intellectual approach and his approachable and pleasant affect made the greatest impact. He spoke softly but firmly, with no trace of demagoguery. As I witnessed in South Lebanon in the early 1970s, Habash could keep an audience rapt for hours, in spite of the complexity of his ideas. With its Marxist-Leninist affinity, the PFLP was popular among students, the educated, the middle class, and particularly those drawn to leftist politics. It also had a dedicated following in the refugee camps, where its radical message resonated strongly with the Palestinians who had suffered the most. Fatah, by contrast, was decidedly non-ideological in its political approach when compared to the PFLP and other avowedly leftist Palestinian groups. At the time of its founding, Fatah represented a reaction both to the Arab nationalist orientation of groups like MAN and the Ba'ath Party, and to communist, leftist, and Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, which argued for societal change before other problems, notably that of Palestine, could be addressed. Fatah's call for direct and immediate action by Palestinians, as well as its broad-tent non-ideological stance, was one of the factors that rapidly enabled it to become the largest political faction. Some of the details are hazy, but we know that Fatah was founded in Kuwait in 1959 by a group of Palestinian engineers, teachers, and other professionals, headed by Yasser Arafat. The core of the group had coalesced earlier in the Gaza Strip and in the universities of Cairo, where it competed with MAN for leadership of the Union of Palestinian Students. Salah Khalaf, Abu Iyad, once told me an emblematic story about Arafat and university politics in Cairo. In danger of losing a student election the following day to MAN, Arafat said he had an idea and took Khalaf to visit someone he knew at the Egyptian Interior Ministry. They sat drinking tea and coffee and making small talk until the man had to leave his office for a moment, at which point Arafat leaped up, went behind the official's desk, did something furtive, and returned to his seat. When the man returned, the two took their leave. Khalaf objected that they hadn't once brought up the imminent election. Arafat told him to go home. The problem was solved. The next day, Khalaf glumly went to the union office to wait out the election, only to find an official-looking notice on the door, stamped by Egypt's Ministry of the Interior, ordering the election postponed. This was Arafat's doing, and he used the delay, Khalaf said, to enroll Palestinian students studying at Al-Azhar University, many of whom were blind, and none of whom had been courted for their votes by the competing factions. When the election was finally held, they voted en bloc for the Fatah list, securing its victory. Fatah's main, indeed only, focus was the Palestinian cause. To further this end, Fatah called for a campaign of direct armed action against Israel, which it launched on January 1, 1965, with its sabotage attack on the water pumping station in central Israel. Like much of what Fatah did in this era, the act was more symbolic than effective. Nonetheless, Egyptian officials considered Fatah to be dangerously adventurous at a time when Egypt could ill afford such provocations across its borders. While MAN and other groups made excuses for the inaction of the nationalist regimes they were associated with, Fatah deliberately tried to show up the Arab states for their lack of true commitment to Palestine. This posture infuriated the regimes, especially since Fatah's fervent rhetoric was not matched by much effective armed action. But it went over well with most Palestinians, who were frustrated by the Arab state's lack of engagement. It was also attractive to many Arab citizens who supported the Palestinians and shared their frustrations. This appeal to public opinion over the heads of the Arab regimes via direct action against Israel was one of the great secrets to the early success of the Palestinian resistance groups, especially Fatah. They spoke to the widespread sense among Arabs that an injustice had been done in Palestine and that their governments were doing nothing substantive about it. In the years during which this appeal was effective, throughout the 1960s and 1970s, the support for the Palestinian resistance by a broad sector of public opinion served to restrain even undemocratic Arab governments. However, that restraint had severe limits, which were reached when Palestinian militancy threatened the Arab state's domestic status quo or provoked Israel to take action. In the meantime, the small militant groups went from strength to strength, and it became clear that a full-scale revival of the Palestinian national movement was underway. By the mid-1960s, this coalescing movement threatened to seize the initiative in the conflict with Israel from the Arab states, and indeed helped to precipitate the events that led to the 1967 war. For all their rhetoric, most of the Arab states, Syria being the exception under the ultra-radical regime in power from 1966 to 1970, were preoccupied with other issues, and were deeply reluctant to challenge a status quo that heavily favored Israel, whose demonstrated military power they regarded with trepidation. While in the West, Israel still retained its image as a beleaguered victim of Arab hostility, this was far from how it was seen in the Arab world, which instead viewed its decisive military victories and potential possession of nuclear weapons as evidence of towering strength. To co-opt and control the rising tide of Palestinian nationalist fervor, the Arab League, under Egypt's leadership, founded the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1964. This was meant to be a tightly controlled subsidiary of Egyptian foreign policy that would channel and manage Palestinian enthusiasm for striking against Israel. But this attempt to keep the Palestinians under Arab tutelage rapidly unraveled. In the immediate wake of the 1967 war, the militant Palestinian resistance groups took over the PLO, sidelining its Egypt-oriented leadership. Arafat, as the head of Fatah, the largest of these groups, soon became the chairman of the PLO Executive Committee, a post he retained, among others, until his death in 2004. Henceforth, the Arab states were obliged to take account of an independent Palestinian political actor, based mainly in the countries bordering Israel, a situation that had already proved problematic for these states and that would eventually become a source of great vulnerability for the Palestinian movement. The rise of this independent actor further complicated the strategic situation of the border states, notably Egypt and Syria. While it constituted a grave domestic problem for Jordan and Lebanon, both of which had large, restive Palestinian refugee populations. For Israel, the reemergence of the Palestinian national movement as a force in the Middle East, and increasingly on the global stage, constituted a great irony. Its victory in 1967 had helped to precipitate even more intransigent Palestinian resistance. This constituted a sharp reversal of one of Israel's great successes of the 1948 to 1967 period, in which the very issue of Palestinian nationhood had almost been fully eclipsed in both arenas. The return of the Palestinians, whose disappearance would have signified a final victory for the Zionist project, was a most unwelcome apparition for Israel's leaders. As unwelcome as the return of any indigenous population would be for a settler colonial enterprise that believed it had dispensed with them. The comforting idea that the old will die and the young will forget, a remark attributed to David Ben-Gurion, probably mistakenly, expresses one of the deepest aspirations of Israeli leaders after 1948. It was not to be. While the Palestinian resurgence posed little or no threat to Israel in strategic terms, although the attacks by militant groups did create serious security problems, it constituted an entirely different kind of challenge on the discursive level, one that was existential. The ultimate success of the Zionist project, as hardline Zionists defined it, depended in large measure on the replacement of Palestine by Israel. For them, if Palestine existed, Israel could not. Israel was, in consequence, obliged to focus its powerful propaganda machine on a new target, while still having to counter the efforts of the Arab states. Since, from the Zionist vantage point, the name Palestine and the very existence of the Palestinians constituted a mortal threat to Israel, the task was to connect these terms indelibly, if they were mentioned at all, with terrorism and hatred, rather than with a forgotten but just cause. For many years, this theme was the core of a remarkably successful public relations offensive, especially in the United States. Finally, the reemergence of the Palestine question posed a problem for U.S. diplomacy, which, with SC-242, had chosen to ignore it and act as if the Palestinians did not exist. For a decade thereafter, the United States strove to keep its head in the sand, even as much of the international community began to extend to the Palestinian movement some degree of recognition. This U.S. stance was in keeping with pronounced Israeli preferences, and it was made possible by the inadequate representation by the Palestinians of their own cause in the U.S. arena and the weakness of pro-Palestinian sentiment in American public opinion. At the same time, administrations from that of Nixon onward also gave various forms of covert and overt support to military action directed against the PLO by Israel, Jordan, Lebanese factions, and Syria.